This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 21st of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 132nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're jam-packed and we're talking new beginnings, first days, new jobs and fresh ideas. And we've crammed in a series of super stories from all over the world. Well, what did you expect? First up, what do you do when you're the new culture minister for the Serbian government? I know that was on your mind. Well, you get your office spray-painted by guerrilla graffiti artists in the dead of night, of course.
Not only interesting because we're painting something very unusual and done for the first time. Another first time thing is some of us have never worked together. So in a way it's going to be an experiment and a challenge.
We'll also follow Sarah McCrory, our pal from Frieze London, as she embarks on her new career as director for Glasgow International Art Festival.
Jordan's used to showing those works in very grand white cube spaces, which we don't have. You know, we don't have that facility. So it's about embracing what we have and in some ways enhancing it.
And can the Basque separatist movement be funny? We take a look at a new Spanish rom-com that wrestles one of Spain's cultural elephants in the room. Etta? I haven't even kissed her yet. That joke's not actually in it.
Mira, si el nombre tiene que ser de aquí, prefiero llamarme Anne.
Vale, Anne. Pero tú sígueme el rollo, vale? A partir de ahora eres mi madre.
Plus, we'll reimagine the concept of the album with architecture in Helsinki at a Melbourne shopping mall. We'll set sail for a desert island to find the objects behind a very new kind of art auction and meet the ad agency mapping the unmapped in the favelas of Rio. Tie it all up with one hell of a session from the new album of the mighty Nick Waterhouse. And I'd say you've got yourself a mighty fine culture show with me, Robert Bounds, right here on Monocle 24. So we'll keep the energy up now with this week's session from Nick Waterhouse. He's the cat from San Francisco with the retro vibe, the jazz in his fingertips, the rhythm in his wrist, the blues in his toes, the rock and roll in the curl of his lip, and a bit of funk on the brain besides. His new record, Holly, about some fictional babe, is out now. It's brilliant, and Nick came in with his full band, and what a tight outfit they are, to play some songs from it. It was a wild Friday afternoon, and everyone got down and danced. First up, here is Nick Waterhouse with Dead Room.
Well, as soon as you get to carry a tune, oh, they put you in the dead room.
Put you in the dead room.
I can't get away too soon. Put me in the dead room.
Put you in the dead room.
Oh, I know they got pedigrees and telling you they got one of these. There's a dead room.
Put you in the dead room.
Book it out about 7 days. Oh, you're working in a dead room.
Put you in the dead room.
Oh, let's talk about standing waiting. We'll be right back.
Yeah, it's Nick Waterhouse with Dead Room from the new album Holly, and there'll be plenty more of that to come throughout the show. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where the theme of this week's show is New Beginnings, something that Serbia's visual artists are cautiously welcoming. The election of a new government, and with it a new Minister of Culture, seems to be bringing about some positive change. And it's sorely needed. The country's most important galleries have been closed for years thanks to botched renovation projects. That left many artists with nowhere to exhibit but the streets. So it seems only fitting that the new man at the Culture Ministry had asked graffiti artists to spray his previously conservatively decorated offices. Our Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaney has been finding out if this could be more than just a quick paint job.
This is a party to celebrate the fifth birthday of KC Grad, the city cultural centre in Belgrade. It has rather a nice thrown-together feel about it, in keeping with the Savamala neighbourhood next to the railway tracks on the riverfront. But it's actually one of the best places that Belgrade's art scene has got, with a gallery, bar and performance and retail spaces. And considering that Serbia's main art galleries have been closed for years, getting to your fifth birthday counts as something of an achievement.
Nowadays in Serbia, to be involved in culture and survive for a few years, that's a big challenge. So I guess things are changing, but I don't think it will be something really rapidly, but I'm sure it will be much better.
Ludmila Stratomirovic is the artistic director of KC Grad.
I studied in the end of 80s, actually in the beginning of 90s. I started to do my own projects, art projects, when it was really, everything was collapsing, and so nothing to buy in shops, no equipment. But then, in a way, you know, it's always a challenge if you feel like artist, you cannot do anything else except art. And we don't know for other conditions to work, so you have to adjust always.
KC Grad isn't just celebrating its birthday. The people here are also excited about a major artistic coup. Serbia's new Minister of Culture has asked Grad to coordinate the interior decoration of his headquarters. And this won't be the usual government ministry chintz, but the bold styles of graffiti art.
The way we met him was also interesting because he just came here to our place, which is more underground cultural center comparing to the other institutions. So I don't know, I guess he would like to show what's going on in Serbia and to support and to change the way we all think about culture.
Graffiti artists have long been busy in Belgrade. There's no shortage of crumbling concrete in the city, and much of it is covered with a mixture of murals, tags, and 3D lettering. This is the work of artists like the relative veteran Lortek and his younger colleague TKV, otherwise known as the Fairy Queen.
I can say that I witnessed the change from completely people who didn't know what is graffiti or graffiti is something that is completely violent and it's vandalism, to this point where we are invited to Ministry of Culture. And our friend from the UK, from London, he said like 5 years ago, if you said I'm doing graffiti, they will call cops, you know, right away. And now when you say I'm doing graffiti, it's everybody knows, at least they know about Banksy, at least.
When they see us putting color somewhere, I mean, they are a bit skeptical. They ask us like, is somebody paying this, or is it something political, or is it like something commercial? And if we explain it's not, they're really amazed.
You're actually looking around as we're talking. What, yes. What are you seeing? When
I see a lot of opportunities.
Lortek and TKV mix guerrilla painting with commercial commissions. Now they've got their biggest job yet, making their mark on the Ministry of Culture.
Not only interesting because we're painting something very unusual and done for the first time. Another first time thing is some of us have never worked together. So in a way it's going to be an experiment and a challenge. And in the end, it's definitely going to look like some sort of collage of different styles and techniques.
We'll also do some portraits of famous like poets and painters, and like I chose like poets and painters that I like personally, but they are really like significant for the culture.
So it's easy to understand the celebratory mood at KC Grad. Years of conflict and stagnation left Serbia's visual arts scene in the doldrums, and everyone's hoping the new Minister of Culture's bold commission is a sign of better times ahead. But there's also caution. There's little point in giving a rusty old car a respray while leaving the chassis to rot. Grad's Ludmila Stratomirovic is withholding judgment.
I don't want to really feel like it's such a big thing, that it's a new beginning, because, I don't know, the situation here is we always have to be very realistic and not to expect too much.
But the graffiti artists are a little more effusive.
It has a big potential, especially the public view of the whole graffiti and street art thing, and that's what I'm interested the most, to see what the response is going to be, because definitely they're going to see it with different eyes after they know that that stuff is inside the Ministry of Culture.
The spraying of the ministry starts next month. You've just got to hope they make it open to the public. For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Thanks, Guy, and this is Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. This week, we're exploring new beginnings and from one person in a new job to another, and this one's a little closer to home. Sarah McCrory made her name in the London art world as curator of Free's projects. Indeed, you may have heard her on this very show. But after last year's Free, she packed her bags and headed north to become director of Glasgow International Art Festival. The first edition of the event under her tenure has just kicked off, and Angela Shackle went to meet her to hear how the first year has gone so far.
The first thing I did was to try really hard to kind of remember and to write down a bit of what I felt about the city as a visitor from the beginning. You know that thing when you go somewhere and then later on you can't remember what you first felt about it? And I've been trying really hard to remember that, because I think it's really important that that affects how you think about things subsequently. But then also you need to take on how you feel about it when it becomes your home.
Sarah McCrory is standing in the McClelland Galleries, one of over 50 sites being used for this year's Glasgow International Art Festival, and a venue which she has curated. It's a building with a rich history in its own right, operating as a gallery in downtown Glasgow for over 150 years. But it has also been given a bit of a new beginning with this year's Art Biennial. For the past 7 years, the gallery's gorgeous marble columns, vaulted ceilings, and grand spiral staircases have all been closed to the public. The decay of the building remains evident, and instead of being glossed over, artists have incorporated this unique environment in the installation of their works.
4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. Jordan Wolfson, his films, he had a big hand in where they were positioned and where they would go. And so not only do we have films in the more extravagant, bold, wood-panelled statement spaces, but also in the toilet. It was about completely investing in the whole building.
Yeah, and the sinks and the toilet still full of water.
Yeah.
I like that.
I didn't know. I mean, we said to Jordan, what level of cleaning do you want to happen in this? This is the ladies' toilet where we're showing his first animation, so a key piece in his kind of career. And he was like, no, leave it all. So there's paper towels, there's an empty Ribena bottle on a baby changing table. I mean, it's all there. You know, Jordan's used to showing those works in very grand white cube spaces, which we don't have. You know, we don't have that facility. So it's about embracing what we have and in some ways enhancing it through the use of those different spaces.
Nostalgia and marriage of tension, building a house of generational spending in Burnley.
I've made 10 exhibitions with 11 artists, but actually across the board there are over 55 different things to see across the city. Yesterday I spent a day going and seeing things, because even though it's, you know, in some ways I feel like I should have seen everything by now, but I haven't by any means. So I got to see some exhibitions by some recent graduates, which is Fantastic. There's a nice show by Jay Mosher and Lauren Hall. So whilst there are artists who've just had a solo show at David's Werner in New York, and there are artists who have, you know, graduated a year ago from the MFA here, it's important that they're all shown together. It sounds like a simple thing, but the guide order is the order you would go from walking from the local subway across to those spaces, making it look like everything is as important as each other.
In addition to the emphasis Sarah has on presenting art in a way that is to be discovered more than ranked, she also made a point of including non-traditional venues and the city itself in her presentation of this year's Glasgow International.
Some of the aspects around its history around shipbuilding and industry have shaped how the city sits now. And those things are really interesting to me personally. They might not be to other people. That's the other thing. They might just want to see the art and go. But I think people have such a good time coming to Glasgow that it's always somehow embedded in their experience of the festival.
For those unable to attend this year's festival in person, there will be videos, art, and exhibition information posted on the Glasgow International website in the coming weeks. For Monocle in Glasgow, I'm Angela Shackle.
Thank you, Angela. And if you want to hear what else is on at the Glasgow International Art Festival, just visit glasgowinternational.org. You are tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're exploring the theme of new beginnings. You'll hear why later. And next we'll hear how the Humble album has been reinvented in an Australian shopping mall.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging, and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features, and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're talking new beginnings, fresh starts and new ideas. Just a few weeks ago, the Wu-Tang Clan made a big statement about the purpose and value of a physical album by releasing just one copy of their latest work, already valued at $5 million. Another music act with some fresh ideas is Australian independent pop outfit Architecture in Helsinki, who've created the ultimate hands-on experience to accompany their new LP, Now and Forever. Part gallery, part listening booth, and part retail emporium in the middle of a Melbourne shopping mall, fans can come in, learn about the album, and walk away with limited edition merchandise curated by the band. Monocle's Adrian Craddock went along to meet the man behind the till, frontman Cameron Bird.
Towards the end of last year, we were brainstorming ways that we could present the record out into the world. And for us, we sort of felt really suffocated or limited by the amount of options there is in Australia for music retail in a physical sense. So really, without wanting to name those companies, there's only really a couple of companies that sell music in Australia. And whilst we're not trying to take on those companies, we just wanted to be able to present our music and our ideas in a way that felt like we could let them be themselves and be free and also create like a tactile experience for people to come and sort of be with the music and hear the music and experience it physically rather than just being an anonymous experience.
I mean, it's quite unusual for people to have such a close experience with the artist when they're buying an album. You know, usually there's such a disconnect.
I guess part of that is because I curated every single object that's in here in the fit out and everything. It's sort of, you know, it's like a second incarnation of the record in a way. It's like the record and then this experience. Whilst it's the same thing, it's also very much something that we're really proud of and that I'm proud that we've put together, and that I feel like when people come in and they feel confused or curious about what it actually means and what's going on, I can then sort of explain to them the ideas behind what we're doing. So it feels like I can clearly communicate that to people.
That's also something that's really interesting, the place that you've chosen to do this. As you say, it's a really mainstream shopping mall in the middle of Melbourne. Why did you choose this space?
We felt like if we were to put the space in a shopping precinct or an area where we would hang out, like, and where like-minded people would hang out, we felt like, in a way, you're sort of preaching to the converted, because the people in those areas are used to interesting, cool, subversive things happening. So we felt like by putting it into such a mainstream shopping centre that we were casting the net a little further, so to speak. But also, just I think because I am very much a populist, I would like to think that what we're making is really accessible to people, and that they can come to the store and, you know, whether or not they've heard of the band, they're like, oh wow, this is really interesting and this music is really interesting. And I think that it definitely opens up some conversations about the state of the music industry, but it also, oh well, I hope that it inspires people to think outside the box a little bit as far as what you can do with your record and what it is that constitutes a record. I think there's a lot of people that live in a really archaic headspace when it comes to what music means, and it's an industry which is, you know, as is well publicised, really on the decline. So for musicians, especially independent musicians, you've got to try and work out ways in which you can carve out a niche for yourself and make an income for yourself.
I think that's what makes this space even more bold, is that, you know, there isn't a big record label behind this footing the bill. You guys have kind of done it all yourself. So now that you're at the tail end of the project, I mean, do you think it's been worth it? Has it achieved what you set out to do?
That was the other thing. I don't know that we sat down around a table and were like, okay, what do we actually want to achieve here? Like, I think it was more a case of like, you know, we're really into this idea. We feel like people in Melbourne, which is a great city that embraces great ideas, we would hope that they would be into it. And yeah, the response has been great. We've had really great numbers coming into the store. You know, people have bought the record. People have been really into everything in the shop. And like I said, from all walks of life, and from people that may not even necessarily be into our record, but are into the people we've collaborated with and are into the products we've made with them. So it's very much been a really nice uniting community aspect to it as well.
That was Cameron Bird, frontman of Architecture in Helsinki, speaking to Adrian Craddock. The Now and Forever concept store has now come to a close, but their new album of the same title is out now. Still to come in part two, energy, good conversation and tightly nipped trousers from Mr. Nick Waterhouse. We'll meet the ad agency working to map the favelas of Rio. We dig for a new form of buried treasure, a tiny art exhibition by some of the world's biggest names, and sit down to watch the fresh Spanish rom-com bringing a sense of humour to the nation's fractured politics. Much more to enjoy as we explore new beginnings here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. All right, back to this week's very live, very cool, irresistible Midori House session from the man, Nick Waterhouse. From that new record, Holly, this is Sleeping Pills, and then we'll talk to the man himself, all cool and as horn-rimmed as you'd expect.
Had a dream. bitch, I sat on the desk of you, grinning at me at the bones in my bed. Like tea leaves in a china cup.
There's an independent label out of Southern California called Burger Records that's sort of a DIY, very heavily like raw garage rock based thing. But those are all my friends are in those bands. I grew up playing with them. And now when I show up in, say, Rennes, France, I see somebody wearing Burger Records t-shirts and they're all very hip, you know? Same in Berlin, and I'm starting to see people that are fans of that showing up at my gigs, which is great because to me it's the same spirit, it's just a slightly different aesthetic, hence the stage divers.
Do you think that's the thing though, when people go, oh, I'm into this record label, people obviously, people like any indie band, they like an indie label, or they like something that they think that nobody else but a few in the know people like. Is that, that's kind of a nice thing when it's like the dictum about there's only two types of music, good music and bad music.
Right.
People come and they're like, eh, I wouldn't necessarily, I won't listen to rhythm and blues or rock and roll. And then suddenly they're twirling their girlfriend around, or specifically someone they've never met before around to your new record. That must be a nice feeling to be up on stage watching that happen.
That's the trick for me. Yeah, that's what it's all about. I mean, I always was never really hanging out with really subculture or genre-oriented folks too much, and especially in San Francisco, where it was kind of Wild West in terms of what nightlife was like there. I love seeing such a variety in audiences. I mean, I had an amazing gig in Paris the other night, and of all places, having Parisians totally lose their minds and dance, like 700 of them. It was very impressive, not only to me, but to like all of my crew in Paris who were like, how did you do this? Like,
qu'est-ce que c'est le maître?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Nick Waterhouse, you're a smart man.
I would say so.
You've got a nipped-in trouser.
That's true.
You've got a decent leather shoe on with a leather sole.
Shell cordovan, yeah.
Yeah. What happens if someone were to turn up, if a dude were to turn up to one of your gigs, would you regard him with an air of haughty disdain? Would you try and get him to dance, maybe put on a better pair of shoes next time?
I was raised in a community of dudes, so I've learned to speak their language. I I come bearing only an olive branch of rhythm.
That's okay. That's good. I think you need a crest. And that should maybe be a dove.
Yeah.
Like a sort of, I don't know, like a dove in a herringbone suit.
Holding a pair of claves or maracas.
Yeah. Maybe in his wings, but in his beak, he's got an olive branch of peace to all genres and all lovers of all music.
To all dudes.
To all dudes. I'd like for a second to turn it back to the record.
Sure.
Holly came out last month. Holly sounds gorgeous, but who is she?
I just wrote a record about somebody, you know, that doesn't exist. It's like, to me, I feel like as I worked on it, I recognized that I was maybe writing a piece of fiction. I had studied literature and I'd done some cinema studies in college. And so I felt like I was applying a lot of the same techniques to my songwriting and sort of structuring the record and even my concepts. Like I had started picturing the artwork, the cover, which is the portrait of the girl early on. I wanted to kind of depict in a way that subverted maybe the cultural touchstones of what I liked. Like in the 60s, you would buy like a jazz record cover and it'd have a beautiful girl on it. Yeah. And it was always very superficial. And I thought, like, what if I wrote about the interior life of that girl? And
because Holly, you're the subject of your album cover, is a beautiful girl, but she's not a doll.
Yeah, she's not a doll. I wanted her to look like the real young women that I knew in Los Angeles, there's a specific type, it's not a cliche, but it's just this kind of girl that I know that I'm, you know, that I'm friends with, that friends of mine are involved with, that have like always been around. And I felt like nobody had really depicted her. I wanted to make like a cross between, say, like Madame Bovary and like a contemporary Echo Park, you know, hipster, you know.
Wow, that I like.
Yeah.
That's quite a girl.
Yeah, and yeah. I thought that would make for interesting listening. And don't ask me why. I didn't think that consciously. I think unconsciously I arrived at that.
That was Nick Waterhouse's new record, Holly, is out now. And you can catch him playing all over the US from June. Just visit nickwaterhouse.com for more details. This is Culture on Monocle 24, where this week we're exploring new ideas, original projects and fresh beginnings. And now we're off to meet an ad agency embarking on an innovative new project in Rio de Janeiro. The city is home to around 1,000 favelas, but trying to navigate your way around any of them is not such an easy task. So the community started to map the areas themselves. Monocle's Rio correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, went to see how Rio's favela culture is being put on the map.
The sounds of community chatter and kids playing echo throughout the streets of Parada de Lucas, just like any other part of Rio de Janeiro. Still though, Parada de Lucas is often overlooked by many of Rio's residents. It remains an unpacified favela, meaning that there's no 24-hour police presence. Internet giants have ignored communities like this, making them invisible on mapping technologies. That's Marcus Dovinicius Santos, the communications officer for 880, a social media agency for the NGO Afro Reggae. Himself, along with a handful of others, are behind the initiative that's getting Parada de Lucas on the map.
Cristo Redentor, Pão de Açúcar e favelas. Sim, favelas.
Working with established advertising agency JWT Brazil, the Tá no Mapa project has really started to take off.
Na favela tem muita vida e muita história, mas no mapa ela não tem nada.
The multinational agency laid its roots in Brazil back in 1929, making it the first of its type to set up in the country. But while their expertise has helped increase visibility, Marcus says the success of the project is down to the local community doing what it's already doing, navigating its way through the favela via their smartphones.
A gente começou a dar
We started to attach this way of mapping. We recruited some youths and we trained these youth adding to what they already knew. And we started to map businesses in Parada de Lucas. We realized the process to spread this mapping would be like riding a bike. Anyone can learn, and once you learn, you'll never forget.
This isn't just about mapping geographical locations. It's also about mapping cultural nuances, like local businesses and social hubs.
We're mapping entrepreneurial opportunities here, and we're getting a better understanding of how the middle class works, specifically in Parada de Lucas, which is where the 880 office is based. A lot of people who lived on one point of the favela didn't go to the other part, so most of those businesses aren't even known by local residents.
Agora você pode navegar pelas ruas, conhecer novos lugares e saber mais.
From everything to local restaurants to tailors to the woman who sells cake out of her own kitchen, local residents started to communicate and learn that there's a booming economy literally in their own backyard, as Moro Calvaletti, the chief integration officer for JWT Group, explains.
When you work in advertising, you work in communications, and advertising is not only selling goods, it's not only promoting products that can be sold in supermarkets.
It's understanding how does all this the small business and micro business work in Brazil. You know, like we're now having access to understand all these companies, how they connect to each other, how they network, how they communicate, how they promote themselves, what kind of communication they use and what kind of advertising they do.
And a lot is being learned on a personal level too.
I can say that I'm learning what is the language, what are the cultural touching points, the emotional touching points. I'm witnessing how people from the community communicate to people in the community, and you know, what's the language, what's the how things flow in the terms of communication. This is very rich. This is a great opportunity.
Ta no Mapa is doing much more than it originally set out to do. In addition to getting these favelas put on the digital map, the project is making the local culture more visible too. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena. You are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. From opening up culture in Brazil, we're going to bury it in Costa Rica. Next.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barena, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, a show this week dedicated to new beginnings. For centuries, the idea of buried treasure has inspired fantasies, literary endeavours, and actual treasure-seeking voyages. But early in May, TBA 21, a Vienna-based art foundation founded and run by art patron Francesca von Habsburg, is turning the buried treasure idea on its head. The foundation's research yacht, the Dardanella, will be making a Pacific voyage, not to find a treasure, but to bury one. A tiny exhibition of work by contemporary art's biggest names, housed in a pressurised object that may never be seen again after it's hidden on the original treasure island. Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley met exhibition curator Nadim Saman in Vienna to find out if X marks the spot.
This object is a truncated tetrahedron, so it's a very interesting geometric form with lots of different angles. It's made of stainless steel, highly polished, and it opens up into a kind of geometric clam, sort of opens like an oyster almost. And inside it, there is a glass sphere. This glass sphere has a diameter of 50 centimeters, and it's a pressure vessel inside which you would normally put a camera that you would send to the bottom of the sea floor. Inside there, the works will be housed, and it's vacuum sealed, so they won't be affected at all by humidity or temperature changes and the like. And this chest is approximately, let's say, a meter by a meter. The works themselves will be in a variety of media, from the very traditional works on paper, rolled up, scroll-like, inside a container, through to LP records, and digital files as well, that will be installed, as it were, on a hard drive inside there. And there are also small-scale sculpture.
Why Cocos Island?
Simply because Cocos Island is the original treasure island. It's the place where all the stories and legends that we've grown up hearing about actually have their genesis. So Robert Louis Stevenson, when he was writing the Treasure Island novel, was in fact inspired by stories of a treasure hunting expedition to Cocos Island that was reported in a newspaper in San Francisco where he was living at the time. The reason these stories emanate from there is because there are three very famous treasures that are purported to have been buried there, and that, you know, the evidence sort of shows are highly likely to be there still.
Will anyone see this exhibition, and what happens to the exhibition after it's buried?
I very much hope that no one will see the exhibition in the immediate sense. So this is a buried exhibition. It's called Treasure of Lima, a Buried Exhibition. And the experience of the exhibition can only truly be had, I think, if someone manages to A, locate where we've buried it, B, dig it up, and open the chest and sort of discover what has been interred within this chest. We will not be telling anyone what's going in it. We're giving the artist names, we're not saying what the objects are, we're not photographing them, and the rest of it. Why don't we want anyone to see it? Well, precisely because Cocos Island is a protected place. It's a Costa Rican national park. for the fact that it's a place of incredible natural importance. As I mentioned already, the sea life around there, which is protected, is second perhaps only to the Galapagos in terms of the species and the biodiversity. There are only 5 rangers living on the island full-time at the moment. There are only 3 paths on the island, and the rest of it is pure jungle. Now, what we've done with this project is we've, in a sense, intervened in the legal and the narrative construction of this place. Cocos Island is one of the only places in the world that is specific. Its specific law says you cannot dig for treasure there. It seems strange, but that's because it's one of the only places in the world where people have been continuously going there to look for treasure, you know, with huge amounts of machinery and trying to dig up these sort of vast hoards for hundreds of years now. So there is an official rule against that. So by burying a treasure there, we're sort of challenging the Costa Rican parks and the authorities to say, hey, you know, you need to make sure that this treasure isn't dug up. So it's kind of like a dare. There's no law against burying treasure there, but we did have to get permission.
Somebody will ultimately own at least a type of instructions to the treasure. Could you describe a little bit what your plans are for later?
There's no buried treasure without a map. And this construction, this narrative construction, begins with Cocos Island, with the maps to the treasure of Lima, with the maps to the treasure of Benito Bonito, which is also supposed to be buried there. And so we have a map, but in line with our sort of times, the times we live in, it's a contemporary map. We live in an age of digital mapping. And so we have, of course, the GPS coordinates of where we will be burying this this treasure. Those coordinates are being given to a Dutch artist called Constant Dulat, who is collaborating with a top cryptographer. And those coordinates will then be encrypted. So the result will be a long string of code. That code is going to be put into a physical form, probably on a piece of metal, which will then be put inside a second edition of the treasure chest. So you can imagine a second version of the chest with this kind of string of code inside it. That is then going to auction, and the money raised by the sale of the map and the replica chest will be then donated to the parks authority that takes care of Cocos Island to make sure that, you know, the island is protected from, of course, development, from exploitation in the fisheries, and from perhaps even treasure hunters. The person who buys this map doesn't get the de-encryption key. So they have an unreadable map to a buried treasure or to an exhibition experience. And of course, all treasure maps always have clues and, you know, sort of symbols that are unreadable. That's part of the fun, let's say.
That was TBA 21's curator Nadim Saman speaking to Kimberly Bradley. And you can find out more about the Treasure of Lima, a buried exhibition project, on the TBA 21 website. You're listening to Culture with me, Rob Bound, on Monocle 24. And to finish our New Beginnings show, we're heading over to Spain, where a new box office sensation has the whole country talking. The film Ocho Apellidos Boscos, or 8 Basque Surnames, is not your run-of-the-mill rom-com. And with jokes about separatism, nationalism, and even terrorism, and in a country that's had more than its fair share of all three, the film is being billed as a turning point for Spain and its ability to let go of its violent past. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous met co-scriptwriter Borja Cobillaga in his Malsaña apartment to ask whether Spain really has turned a corner.
We have a very huge tradition about black comedy and how economic or social problems or poverty is a subject for comedy. You have many examples like Berlanga, like Buñuel in the cinema. We have seen a situation that possibly could make a drama plot, but we think we can twist it and make a comedy. It's something in Spain we are used to do. It's part of a big tradition in Spain.
Do you think maybe it also reflects that Spain is ready to laugh about this this kind of thing, because maybe 10, 20 years ago it would not have been possible?
Yeah, I think 10 years ago this kind of film is like Ocho Apellidos Vascos was impossible because the situation, or Vaya Semanita. Vaya Semanita, the TV show I mentioned, was born in a phase that ETA wasn't killing people. It's a little truce in the 10 years ago. And now that it seems that ETA won't kill again, all the suffering is a tragedy. There are people killed by ETA, but I think the society has suffered and a sadness, a very hard pressure. And I think the comedy is a way to get over or move on.
Is it also a way of expressing a sense of helplessness or despair as well? Mm-hmm. Well, if you, with nothing else left, all you can do is, mm-hmm. is laugh.
Yeah, because in the tradition I have told to you, there is a mix of tears and laughs all the time. The tears suddenly is a laugh and vice versa. And I think good comedies, the material of good comedies is that.
Mira, si el nombre tiene que ser de aquí, prefiero llamarme Anne.
Vale, Anne, pero tú sígueme el rollo, ¿vale? A partir de ahora eres mi madre.
I've also heard whispers of another potential film, again dealing with the topic of the Basque identity and also Eta of a man who's undercover, an Eta agent who becomes the president of his building. And
yeah, it's an old project we had, Diego, San Jose and me, and we are very happy about that. It's like a sitcom with Eta. They live in that flat in a Spanish town, and they try to be undercover and discreet about the behavior. And it's not the same thing, because if Ocho Pedidos Vascos is not about politics, this film is more political. But we are not interested in politics. We are interested in the usual day, the
day-to-day life of a terrorist.
The day-to-day life of a terrorist. That
could make a very interesting sitcom.
Yeah. It's a sitcom. Yeah. It's the structure is a classical sitcom.
Also wanted to ask you, when you're sitting at your desk and you're mm-hmm. writing a script, like the scripts you usually write, mm-hmm. how do you approach writing a joke about terrorism?
Well, the thing is, I've lived in the Basque Country for 20 years, and fortunately, I haven't lived an act of terrorism very near. But I felt all the pressure of the context of a violent society, and the more you can see that a politician was killed, a bomb in a police station, that kind of thing it was too normal. And when things like that are too normal, you have to react in some way. Some people react with no reaction because you get used to it, and that's terrible. I think you have to make jokes about it. Not jokes about the victims or jokes about the act of killing itself, but jokes about the situation, the absurd situation you are living. People whose life I used to terrorism, and that's terrible. And I think one of the many reactions you can have, the most healthy
and
reaction
human.
And human is humor.
That was Borja Cobiaga, writer of Ocho Apellidos Boscos, speaking to Liam Aldous. It's been the most successful Spanish film of the year so far, and plans are afoot for an English translation, so watch this space. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be welcoming the man behind Aztec Camera, singer-songwriter Roddy Frame, in for a session and getting a sense on how smell is being explored in art and cinema in Berlin. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bulber, who's about to embark on a new beginning herself, hence our theme. From next week, Daphne Denis will be taking steer of the good ship Culture with the continued support of First Mate Holly Fisher. And on the Pugwash theme, a new Master Bates in the shape of Tom Hall. Time for one final song this week, and what a way to end the show. From his Midori House session, this is Nick Waterhouse with his cover of Roger and the Gypsies' Pass the Hatchet. Thanks as ever for tuning in, and thank you very much, Katie Bulber, for 132 shows of pure magic. It's been an honour and a joy working with you. Thank you very much indeed. It won't quite be the same again, but upwards and onwards. Good luck, Katie, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
Thank you kindly. Thanks, Monica.